5 hours, what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. A U.S. presidential boost for New Orleans. 10 years after Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, Louisiana, killing 1,800 people and destroying 100,000 homes, President Barack Obama hailed the southern U.S. city's revival. In a speech Thursday at a newly built community center in the city's lower Ninth Ward that was badly hit by the hurricane, President Obama highlighted New Orleans' recovery and what he called remarkable progress after suffering massive flooding.
And we came to realize that what started out as a natural disaster became a man-made disaster, a failure of government to look out for its own citizens.
President Obama said that New Orleans' recovery is a model for the nation in urban innovation, disaster response, and resilience. A new report finds that Pakistan is building 20 nuclear bombs a year and could become the world's third largest nuclear power within a decade. The U.S.-based Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and the Stimson Center say Pakistan could possess at least 350 nuclear warheads. Only the United States and Russia would have more than that. The report cites Pakistan's perceived need to keep pace with arch-rival and neighbor India. The Arab League postponed its effort to form a regional military force. That would be to fight Islamic State militants in Libya. The apparent reason? The League's members were divided in their views on the civil war in Libya. According to analysts, the indefinite delay, announced before the meeting, scheduled Thursday in Cairo, was a result of obstacles facing the formation of a pan-Arab force. This is VOA News. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is proposing the creation of a three-person team to investigate chemical weapons attacks in Syria. In a letter to the UN Security Council Thursday, he said the independent panel will try to identify those responsible for using chlorine and other chemical weapons. Earlier this month, the Security Council unanimously adopted a resolution calling for an investigative body to determine who's responsible for the attacks, which have killed and injured many civilians. Ukraine's military and Russia-backed rebels have carried out a prisoner exchange in eastern Ukraine, a result of an agreement this week by the two sides to halt the ongoing violence by September 1st. Officials from both sides say 12 rebel prisoners were swapped for about the same number of Ukrainian servicemen. Ukraine, meanwhile, accused Russia-backed rebels of multiple ceasefire violations on Thursday. As many as 50 refugees were found dead Thursday inside a truck in Austria. The victims reportedly had suffocated. Helmut Marban is a spokesman for the Burgenland police.
They first thought it was an accident. It had an accident, and they checked the car, and they found there was no driver inside it. And they found blood dropping out of the car, and they checked a smell of dead bodies.
Meanwhile, Balkan leaders met in Vienna to discuss ways to stem the migrant crisis. Greece now has its first female prime minister. Chief Supreme Court Judge Vassiliki Tanou was sworn in as a caretaker head of government Thursday. Ms. Tanou and her cabinet will run the country at least until early elections are held September 20th. The former leftist Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras resigned last week. Sri Lanka's efforts to move away from the previous government's tilt towards China got a big boost with the U.S. government's decision to back a domestic investigation into alleged war crimes during the country's civil war. Anjana Pasricha has details.
U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Nisha Biswal visited Colombo a week after the new government secured a victory in parliamentary elections and put an end to hopes of a political comeback by former President Mahinda Rajapaksa. She said a domestic investigation would lead to a more durable outcome. The announcement marks a reversal of Washington's position, which has sponsored resolutions at the United Nations demanding an international probe into war crimes. Anjana Pasricha, New Delhi.
Storm warnings are out for more than a dozen Caribbean islands as Tropical Storm Erica approaches after killing at least three on Dominica. Erica soaked the island with 38 centimeters of rain. Forecasters say Erica will likely hit the Virgin Islands, the Dominican Republic, and the Leeward Islands over the next 2 days. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, August 25th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Tanzania's Electoral Commission promises a credible October poll.
Tanzania has introduced biometric voter registration only for purposes of registration. So I'm saying very firmly that our system has been transparent, has been explained to everybody.
Justice Damian Lubuva is the chairman of Tanzania's National Electoral Commission. The U.S. and the U.N. call for respect for DRC's constitution ahead of the 2016 election. South Sudan rebels are optimistic a newly signed peace deal would finally end their country's civil war. And Nigeria observed 500 days since Boko Haram's abduction of the Chibok girls.
It's unforgivable that we actually allow 219 girls, schoolgirls that went to school to get an education, to be with terrorists for 500 days. And we seem to have moved on. The world seems to have moved on.
Aisha Yusufu is the spokeswoman for the Bring Back Our Girls movement of Nigeria. Hundreds of thousands of forced disappearances remain unresolved globally. And Burkina Faso's parliament opens debate today, Friday, on the death penalty. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The chairman of Tanzania's National Electoral Commission says his organization is determined to ensure a peaceful and credible general election on October 25th this year. Justice Damian Lubuva says the commission is closely working with all political parties to ensure an equal playing field. Some critics have accused the commission of not using a transparent process when it recently compiled a voters list for the elections. They say lack of transparency could undermine the credibility of the election. But Chairman Lubuva tells reporter Peter Clotty that for the first time, the electoral body has used the biometric system to compile the voters' register ahead of the October election.
The position in Tanzania, the election generally has been peaceful. And that is what we are aspiring to achieve in the next elections in October. For that reason, we have been making all necessary arrangements to enable the voters to vote freely.
Honorable Lubuva, I understand the Electoral Commission compiled a voters list that will be used for the elections. Some people questioned that it might not have been necessarily transparent. What is your reaction to such critics saying that the electoral register might not have been transparent enough, which they said could undermine the credibility of the election come October 25th?
Well, on that one, I should make it very clear that the process of voter registration by using the biometric voter registration system for the first time in some quarters was not quite clearly understood by people. That was quite transparent in the sense that before we embarked on that one, we had meetings with various stakeholders, including political parties, religious leaders, civil societies, and we explained that we're going in for a new system of voter registration. But we said very clearly that Tanzania has introduced the biometric voter registration only for purposes of registration. So I'm saying very firmly that our system has been transparent, has been explained to everybody, and with the few machines we use, the biometric voter registration kits, only 8,000 for the whole country, and we have done it, registering about 23 to 24 million people. That's quite a record. In Kenya, they had 30,000 voter registration kits, and they registered only 14. So I think in Tanzania, it's a record, and I'm proud about it.
People are saying that this coming election will be the most competitive when it comes to the presidential election. So my question to you, Honorable Lubuva, is how hard is your Electoral Commission working to ensure that Tanzania prospective voters repose confidence in the Electoral Commission's ability to administer a free, fair, transparent and credible election come October 25th?
From the look of things, as of now, since the competition is going to be quite high, but nonetheless, or nevertheless, on the part of the Electoral Commission, we are, as usual or as before, prepared to carry out the election as smoothly as possible. We are getting ready to have every required material ready for the election.
Justice Damian Lubuva is the chairman of the National Electoral Commission of Tanzania. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Dar es Salaam. The United States and United Nations are urging Congo to abide by its election calendar and the presidential two-term limit. The new U.S. Special Envoy to Africa's Great Lakes region, Thomas Perello, spoke to the media in the DRC capital this week after meeting with President Joseph Kabila. Nick Long has more for VOA.
According to the DRC constitution, presidential elections should be held here by November 2016. A move by the government to organize a new census that might have delayed the elections provoked violent protests in January. Visiting Kinshasa on Wednesday, U.S. Ambassador Thomas Perriello told reporters he had productive meetings, including an important introductory conversation with President Kabila.
In the meeting with President Kabila, we were able to have a very constructive exchange about issues including armed groups and refugees in the East, timely and peaceful elections, as well as the situation in Burundi and the issue of adoptions.
Asked what the U.S. could do to encourage respect for the constitutional two-term limit, Perriello said U.S. President Barack Obama has spoken of his personal deep belief and the United States' collective deep belief in constitutionalism and rule of law. Respecting both of those concepts is essential for stability and development, said Perriello. The conversation with President Kabila on the electoral calendar and other issues was very constructive, he said, adding he was sure there would be further talks on holding the presidential and legislative elections by the end of next year. That same day, the head of the UN mission in Congo, Martin Kobler, also spoke to media about upcoming polls, including the provincial elections slated for this October. Kobler was asked if MONUSCO is downplaying the importance of holding those elections at that time.
Je crois il faut rapidement déterminer le calendrier.
I don't know if it's realistic to have local elections in October, Kobler said.
Notre position est très claire. La constitution doit être gardée.
Our position is very clear, he added. The constitution must be respected. The legislative and presidential elections must take place in November 2016, and nothing that happens between now and then should jeopardize the November 2016 date for the presidential elections. A spokesman for civil society groups in North Kivu province, Gento Maundu, told VOA he agreed with Kobler that October is not a realistic date for holding local elections. The problem, Maundu said, is that the government has not provided enough funding to the Electoral Commission. He also said he thought the prospect of presidential elections in 2016 is doubtful, as some opposition parties, he said, want to negotiate a transition with President Kabila, which could last 3 or 4 years. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
South Sudanese rebels say they are hopeful a newly signed peace treaty will be carried out and eventually bring to an end the country's 20-month-old civil war. Lenny Ruvaga reports.
At a news conference in Nairobi Thursday, rebel representatives called on the government and their own side to adhere to the peace treaty signed by President Kiir in Juba on Wednesday. Thieu Mathok Wall, the deputy chief negotiator for rebels at peace talks in Ethiopia, said his side is prepared to make the treaty a reality.
We are ready. We commit ourselves into implementation of this peace agreement. We believe that next 72 hours, the process of the permanent ceasefire, which is stipulated in the peace agreement, will take place. And we will realize stability in our country.
President Kiir expressed strong reservations about the agreement Wednesday, and rebel chief Riek Machar said that casts doubt on the government's commitment to the treaty. Low-level fighting was reported in the town of Bentiu on Thursday. The United Nations and African Union have accused the warring parties of committing human rights abuses during the conflict, including the forced recruitment of child soldiers. Stephen Park-Wall, the spokesman for the rebels at the peace talks, was upbeat that the treaty will finally usher in justice for the aggrieved.
The AU report is very important. The AU Commission report has been partially released, as you know. We welcome that. It might be made public through the judicial process. In this agreement, we have hybrid courts that is being established by the agreement, and it will be negotiated soon how to establish that body.
The civil war broke out in December 2013 after a fallout between President Kiir and his former deputy, Riek Machar. The fighting has killed thousands and forced an estimated 2.2 million South Sudanese from their homes. Michael Toot, a refugee from South Sudan, barely escaped the conflict and lost three of his relatives in the town of Bor. But Toot said he is hopeful peace can be achieved.
I'm optimistic that if the two warring parties are committed, a long-lasting peace will be achieved in South Sudan.
The United States had proposed an arms embargo on South Sudan and sanctions against top rebel leaders beginning September the 6th unless Mr. Kiir signed the pact. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barte in Washington. Today's Friday, August 28th. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's give a shout out to listeners on our affiliate station, Radio Banga FM 96.5 in Bong County, Central Liberia, and Capital FM in Blantyre, Malawi. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. Burkina Faso's parliament opens debate today, Friday, on whether to abolish the death penalty in the country. Gaetan Mutu, a researcher at Amnesty International, tells Ricky Shryak the odds are high that the country will eventually abolish the death penalty at the September 6th vote.
We are very happy that the bill will be debated at the Transitional Assembly. We believe that the tendency towards abolition is moving forward, especially in Burkina Faso, because the Transitional Assembly proposed a bill to the government, and it looks like the government has accepted the bill, has signed it off, and has sent it back to Parliament to be voted.
Is there any chance, though, since this is a transitional government, that even if this abolition happens and the death penalty is abolished right now, it could eventually come back because a new leader could say this happened under the transitional government, so it's null and void, doesn't count.
I think that it's unlikely that the decision to move backward will happen because the transitional assembly has got the same rights as the former parliament, which was deposed after the unrest last year.
Is there anyone on death row right now in Burkina? And in the past, what have been the conditions that someone would get sentenced to the death penalty?
There are many causes. The death penalty is still in force in Burkina Faso, but over the last 3 decades, nobody has been executed in Burkina Faso. It's a de facto abolitionist country, and there was a big movement towards the abolition of the death penalty in Burkina Faso.
How has traditional culture in Burkina Faso regarded the death penalty?
It is interesting just to note that the way forward towards abolition has been raised with political leaders, with organizations of civil society, and also with religious bodies, so that this bill could be approved. However, it would be difficult for me just to assess whether the people in Burkina Faso will agree to this decision. But however, working with a human rights organization, I tend to meet mainly people working with non-governmental organizations and human rights organizations, and most of them, if not all of them, are in favor of the abolition of the death penalty. And they have been working with traditional leaders, they have been working with citizens in the villages to prepare for the abolition of the death penalty. Having said that, I do understand that there are some people who may be opposed to the abolition of the death penalty in Burkina Faso.
There will be a parliamentary vote on the 6th of September as to whether to abolish the death penalty or not. After that vote, does it go into law or does it need another approval?
Yes, it will go into law. The law has got to be signed by the president, and then it is a law.
That was Gaetan Mutu, a West Africa researcher for Amnesty International. He was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Paris. A spokeswoman for the Bring Back Our Girls movement of Nigeria says rescuing the Chibok girls is a constitutional right that the Nigerian government must fulfill. Aisha Yesufu says the failure to liberate the girls from Boko Haram captivity has emboldened the terrorist group to continue taking more hostages. The Islamist extremist group kidnapped more than 270 girls from the Chibok boarding school in northern Nigeria in April 2014. Yesterday, Thursday, the movement marked 500 days since the abduction with a youth rally in the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Spokeswoman Yesufu says the whole world should continue to rally around the girls until they are rescued, because no one is safe as long as the girls remain in captivity.
It's unforgivable that we actually allowed 219 girls, schoolgirls that went to school to get an education, to be with terrorists for 500 days. And we seem to have moved on. The world seems to have moved on. It's just not fair on the Chibok girls. It's not fair on the children of the world. It's not fair on the girl child. By not rescuing the Chibok girls, we have not only failed the Chibok girls, we have failed children of Nigeria and the world at large. These children now know that when they go to school, they are not safe. They can be taken away by anybody, and nothing will be done about it.
The Nigerian government under President Goodluck Jonathan and the military were criticized for not doing enough. Do you think the military under President Buhari is doing enough right now to rescue those girls?
Well, doing enough will be the rescue of our girls. What we say is that there has been like a change in the body language. There has been sincerity of purpose towards fighting the insurgency and trying to get the girls rescued. Under President Goodluck Ebele Jonathan, what we had was practically denial. By the time we say anything, we had a president who called us psychological terrorists because we stood up and demanded for the rescue of girls that were abducted. The former president saw himself as a victim and not the Chibok girls that were abducted. And with the present president, President Muhammadu Buhari, we have seen a change in the attitude towards the Chibok girls. He has sort of like taken ownership of the problem, the rescue of the Chibok girls. We heard in his inaugural speech where he made mention of the fact that the war against insurgency would not be said to have been won without the rescue of the Chibok girls. So that says so much. Not only does he want these girls to be rescued, to be brought back home to their parents, but equally wants them to have a future, to go on to have a life that somebody somewhere tried to truncate, that has been interrupted by the terrorists for 500 years. For us, it is not about who is president. It is about the Nigerian government. And it is the duty of the Nigerian government to rescue the Chibok girls. And we have to understand something. The rescue of the Chibok girls or coming out to stand for them is not a privilege. It is their right as enshrined in the Constitution of the Federal Republic of Nigeria.
Soon after the girls were abducted, there was an international outcry. Do you think that outcry is still there, or do you think the international support has kind of subsided?
Well, the international outcry that we had, at the magnitude in which we had it, of course, is no longer there. But we still have international people who are committed to the cause, who every day, we have Congresswoman Federica Wilson of the U.S., we have Congresswoman Shirley Jackson of the U.S., you know, standing every day for the Chibok girls. So we still have people who are committed to the cause. But overall, what we had was that in the early days, it was glamorous, it was sophisticated for people to hold the banner that says Bring Back Our Girls.
Aisha Yesufu is the spokeswoman for the Bring Back Our Girls movement of Nigeria. She was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. Sunday, August 30th, is the International Day of the Disappeared. In advance of the observance, the International Committee of the Red Cross is appealing to governments and civil society to document the fate and whereabouts of people who have gone missing in conflicts and other disasters. The group hopes this would alleviate the suffering of thousands of families who are living in a state of limbo. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from ICRC headquarters in Geneva.
A Latin American non-governmental organization created the International Day of the Disappeared in Costa Rica in 1981. The aim was to draw attention to the fate of individuals imprisoned under horrible conditions in places unknown to their families. This period was marked by the disappearance of tens of thousands of people in the so-called Dirty War in Argentina, in the military coup in Chile, and as a consequence of political unrest in other Latin American countries. More than four decades later, hundreds of thousands of old and new cases of disappearances remain unresolved. But Francis Marcus, spokesman for the International Committee of the Red Cross, tells VOA the issue since has become more complex and has broadened to include people who have gone missing in natural disasters or in the process of migration, as well as in war.
No matter what the circumstances are of people's disappearance, the suffering and the anguish and the uncertainty which families face is the same. And so we desperately need to bring more awareness to the issue, and we need governments and civil society to do more to make sure that whatever documentation can be done in real time is being done so that it might be useful to provide answers in the future.
Marcos says clarifying the whereabouts of a missing loved one would provide both emotional and practical support. It also would allow people to move forward with their lives financially.
In many cases, they are not able to access the person's property or the person's salary, and they're left in serious economic difficulties. So there are many sort of practical issues with which families need support, as well as emotional issues.
The ICRC is tackling the issue of disappearances in dozens of countries around the world, including major hotspots in the Middle East and Africa. It is working to trace those who have gone missing. It documents information for present and future use. It offers a variety of support to the families of the missing, ranging from economic security programs and livelihoods to legal advice. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Time now for Daybreak Africa. Sports, and here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin at the World Athletics Championships in Beijing, China. South African Anaso Jobodwana clocked a lifetime best of 19.87 seconds to clinch a bronze medal in men's 200 meters on Thursday. What's more, he improved the South African record from 19.94 seconds set by Wade Vanniekerk in Lausanne, Switzerland last month. On the infield, Nigerian Tosin Oke leapt to a distance of 16.81 meters to place eighth in triple jump. South African Godfrey Kotsomokwena was ninth, while Jonathan Drake of Mauritius was placed 11th. Meanwhile, Kenya continued to lead the World Championship medal table with 6 gold, 3 silver and 2 bronze medals. Ethiopia is 8th with 1 gold and 2 silver medals. South Africa is 10th with 1 gold and 1 bronze medal. Eritrea is 11th with 1 gold medal. Egypt and Tunisia tie in 18th spot with a silver medal each, while Uganda is 27th with 1 bronze medal. There are 34 nations on the medal table as at Thursday. Staying in Beijing, tomorrow Saturday, Morocco's Rababi Arafi joins Kenyan defending champion Eunice Jepkoech Sum in the contesting the women's 800-meter finals. Ethiopians Iman Murgag, Hagos Gebrehiwet, and Yomif Kejelcha, along with Kenyans Edwin Cheriotsoy, Caleb Mwangangi Diku and Isaiah Kiplagat Koech compete in men's 5,000 meters. In basketball news, hosts Tunisia outwitted Mali 70-60 in the quarterfinals at the Africa Men's Basketball Championships in Tunis on Thursday. Nigeria dismissed Gabon 88-64. Senegal outplayed Algeria 75-58 as defending champions Angola beat Egypt 83-63, while Uganda outplayed Zimbabwe 72-64 in a classification tie. Today, Friday, Senegal play Nigeria as Tunisia challenge Angola in the semifinals. In classification matches, Cape Verde Islands engage Cameroon, and Mali play Egypt. Algeria face Gabon. Central African Republic engage Morocco as Ivory Coast encounter Mozambique. Finally, in football, Rwanda host Ethiopia in Kigali today, Friday, as Niger welcome Burkina Faso in Niamey on Sunday in friendly matches. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. That's it for this Friday, August 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford and reporters Peter Clotty, I'm James Botti in Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a very, very good weekend.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act, has been passed, signed, and reauthorized for the next decade, ensuring U.S.-African trade and investment will continue to flourish. Next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on Straight Talk Africa, host Shaka Sali and his guests will discuss the outcome of the AGOA joint conference held in Gabon. That's next time on VOA Africa. Next on Let's Talk. Wife earning more money than her husband. Join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing this sensitive issue. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa. VOA Africa.